Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, Thursday afternoon with coffee edition.
Yes.
Whoa.
Tim, tell us about the coffee.
I was in Grand Rapids for the regional ETS, and Jonathan Fuller hosted us.
Excuse me.
And sent a bag.
You weren't in Grand Rapids for ETS. You were in Grand Rapids for Jonathan Fuller. And the regional ETS just happened to be there.
So I...
Jonathan Fuller give you a line on your CV?
Yes.
Oh! Tim presented this,
Speaking of presentations and stuff, SBL has rejected both of my proposals for this year. So
how does that feel?
It's a life. That's the way these things work.
L'chaim.
L'chaim.
All right. And did we actually say what we're drinking?
No.
No. The coffee is very good. What is it, Tim?
What they're drinking?
Oh. It's Madcap coffee.
Tim is grabbing the bag.
It is Bolt.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to do a thing that's unwise.
Colombian.
That's one of their main blends, Tim.
Just a very little bit. There, that's perfect. So I've been pretty violently ill this week, so I can't smell or taste this. But since I know where it's from, I'm going to do it anyway.
And we're all excited to be in a room with closed, like, air circulation.
Exactly.
And Charlie.
So we'll see if we're all sick next week.
It's viral.
It's viral. Oh, okay, we're good.
And, like, a virus, not, like, really popular.
Yes.
Because those are words that could both mean different things, Tim.
They could. I like it. I think it's nice.
Thank you for the clarification.
I genuinely enjoy when I try to explain things to you. You don't need them explained. It's just so much fun. All right.
I love it.
Here's what we're going to do in this episode.
And I do sometimes need them explained.
Well, when a pop culture reference, like something that's viral, you might need
most definitely
that to be explained. I got to be careful. I'm going to start spewing over my microphone. That is very good coffee. Very good coffee. Actually, Madcap, the like actual coffee shop, is one of my favorite coffee shops.
I agree. I really like their location.
Yep.
It's got a cool vibe. The main one in downtown GR. Yeah,
correct.
That, I like that one a lot.
GR. Can't spell grub without GR. Anyway.
That's what they call it, Tim. That's what the locals call it.
I believe you. Just like we call it DSM.
No, we don't.
I've never heard someone call it that.
We call it the planes.
All right. Here's what we're going to do in this episode. After 3 minutes of nonsensical banter, we are going to do books and business. And then we have our last discussion over the collection of essays known as The Weight of Glory and actually discussing the essay itself, The Weight of Glory. So, with no further delay.
Books and business.
Let's talk about some books. Or in my case, Desires of a Misspent Youth. So the last couple of weeks, it's been the NCAA tournament. And literally, Iowa this year advanced farther in that tournament than they have in my entire lifetime. The last time Iowa basketball went to the Elite Eight was 1987. My parents had not met each other yet. I was born in 1991. So I was a little preoccupied. And having been sick, that's a factor too. But my books in business today is Iowa beating Nebraska to advance to the Elite Eight. And then the next night, Iowa State, just so unfortunately, getting beat by Tennessee. That's my books in business. I'd rate it a 10 out of 10.
I don't
Let's
care.
Hear about your rejection.
Once out of every 300 episodes, I get to talk about sports ball games.
You go ahead.
Okay. So this is the one in the first 300. So I get one between 301 and 600. So I've spent my
Very good.
First one.
All Very right. good.
There's my book space.
So I picked this book up a while ago, and I've been able to pick it up and do a little bit more reading on it. The title is From Front Porch to Back Seat, Courtship in 20th Century America by Beth Bailey.
That's surprising. I didn't think you would pick up a book like that, Tim.
It's an academic title published by John Hopkins University. What?
I was just going to exclaim at our listeners don't get to see reactions. And Josh and I made the exact same reaction. It's like the, oh, face, like the emoji, like, yeah, anyway.
Tim, does this need like parental
anything? No, I'm not going to go into any details here. Actually, I am going to go into some details. It's nothing that's racy.
I don't think I've
racy.
Ever had any episode
okay.
that I have led where I've had to do that.
Tim, are you going to go into details? No, I'm not going to go into details.
Okay, it's
actually,
just about dating.
I am
okay?
going to go into details.
Because the content of the book is not something that needs like parental guidance suggested type of a thing. It's
I believe
talking,
the technical term would be spicy.
There we go. So this was actually really helpful because it uses the word courtship in the subtitle. And when you think through courtship, what is courtship?
Well, it sounds like we're like sort of not an arranged marriage, but like a very scripted plot coordinated by parents and with like lots of other moving parts, which doesn't sound totally unwise. Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes the cultural trope is that it leans into parents running every last little detail of the kids' lives.
I would say like a very conservative, intentional, quote unquote, dating like. They're going to interact with each other, but it's not them going out and seeing if they like each other. It's on the road to marriage under the auspices of the parents. Would that be a fair?
Yeah, I think that's kind of Charlie's is more of the idea of courtship that I think I'm more familiar with. I think that was popularized mostly by Joshua Harris and I Kissed Dating Goodbye. This book does not use that definition of courtship.
This surprises me.
So the book was published back in 1988. So it's before all of that stuff. And the terminology of courtship is a broad term to basically refer to finding a spouse. And so it's like an umbrella term, which could refer to the courtship definition, whatever thing that materialized in the early 2000s or dating, or even an older model, which was known as calling. So on the bottom of page 13, courtship among strangers offered couples new freedom, but access to the public world of the city required money. One had to buy entertainment or even access to a place to sit and talk. Money, men's money, became the basis of the dating system and thus of courtship. So you can see in this quote, the basis of the dating system and thus of courtship. She is equating the two things. Dating is courtship. And it was the old model, which would have been 19. She's really interacting with the 1920s, 1910s, 1920s kind of a model. This new dating system, as it shifted courtship from the private to the public sphere and increasingly centered around money, fundamentally altered the balance of power between men and women in courtship. Okay, so before dating, the common system was called calling, the calling system. In page 15, she writes, the calling system in courtship, though varying by region and the status of the individuals involved, and the only reason I say that quote is to illustrate, the calling system is a form of courtship, just like the dating system is a form of courtship, to illustrate how she is using the two terms. Using the word courtship differently. So that was something I had to wrestle through as I was working through this book. By the way, I found this book very fascinating because it's basically tracing the birth of the dating system. And then what it was birthed out of was the calling system, which we often aren't familiar with. The calling system, let's see here. So she's talking about the redistribution of power. At the top of page 14, it altered the balance of power between men and women in courtship. Indeed, in the calling system, the woman was the one that was in control. On page 20, in the middle, she notes, second, in the calling system, the woman took the initiative. Etiquette books and columns were adamant on that point. It was the quote-unquote girl's privilege to ask a young man to call. Furthermore, it was highly improper for the man to take the initiative. In 1909, a young man wrote to the Ladies' Home Journal advisor asking, "May I call upon a young woman whom I greatly admire, although she had not given me the permission? Would she be flattered at my eagerness, even to the setting aside of conventions, or would she think me impertinent?" And Mrs. Kingsland replied, "I think that you would risk her just displeasure and frustrate your object of finding favor with her." In other words, no. So the woman was the one that actually called and invited the guy over, and so they were the ones that were in control in the calling system. The very next paragraph, contrast these strictures with advice on dating etiquette from the 1940s and 50s. An advice book for men and women warns that, quote, "girls who try to usurp the right of boys to choose their own dates will, quote, ruin a good dating career. Fair or not, it is the way of life. From the Stone Age, when men chased and captured their women, comes the yen of a boy to do the pursuing. You will control your impatience, therefore, and respect the time-honored custom of boys to take the first step." So, the transfer of power or control from calling to dating, we kind of put ourselves in our current world and think it's always been this way, and the book is basically saying, nope. So there's a little snippet of From Front Porch to Backseat Courtship in 20th Century America.
That's fascinating and very unexpected.
For my books and business, we could keep talking about Middlemarch. It's been great. But we're not going to. Although I will say, you get a just incredible insight into the human condition and in the little unwise choices people make and how those choices snowball. And you just see that again and again. And it's really fascinating.
We were at the, Melissa and I were at the scholarship dinner last week. And on our way out, Lily Dowden and another student were sitting there. And they were both reading Middlemarch. And I was like, "How's it going?" And she was like, "Reading it for Dr. Boyd." She seemed pretty excited about it. So, it's thick. You weren't wrong, man.
That's a thick book. I saw Lily in the hallway the other day and I said, "What are you reading?" And I knew what she was reading. But what are you reading? And she said, "Middlemarch. What else would it be?" Or something along those lines. But instead of that, though, we'll talk about an essay by C.S. Lewis. It's in God in the Dock, and it's The Humanitarian Theory of Punishment. And he discusses the humanitarian theory of punishment and argues that it is not humanitarian. He says, "I urge a return to the traditional or retributive theory, not solely, not even primarily, in the interests of society, but in the interests of the criminal." And I'm going to read one paragraph here. "The reason is this: the humanitarian theory removes from punishment the concept of dessert, as in your just desserts, not in the, you know, tasty things that we eat after meals. But the concept of dessert is the only connecting link between punishment and justice. It is only as deserved or undeserved that a sentence can be just or unjust. I do not here contend that the question, is it deserved, is the only one we can reasonably ask about a punishment. We may very properly ask whether it is likely to deter others or to reform the criminal. And those are two key components of the humanitarian theory of punishment. Is it going to deter crime in the future, or is it going to help us in some way reform the criminal?" And he's going to argue that those aren't the most important things to ask. He says, "But neither of these last two questions is a question about justice. There is no sense in talking about a just deterrent or a just cure. We demand of a deterrent not whether it is just, but whether it will deter. We demand of a cure not whether it is just, but whether it succeeds. Thus, when we cease to consider what the criminal deserves and consider only what will cure him or deter others, we have tacitly removed him from the sphere of justice altogether. Instead of a person, a subject of rights, we now have a mere object, a patient, a case." And so he then goes on to contend that what you have happening here is the people that are involved in these kinds of punishments are the expert class who needs to treat the criminal. And you begin to be, you know, it's no longer that you have done something that is sinful and wrong. It's that you have a disease that needs to be cured. And what that leads to then is an indeterminate punishment, because who knows how long it will take us to reform this particular criminal. And it also then leads to totalitarian regimes taking advantage of this, because once you do away with justice, then you can see as the disease whatever you decide the disease is. And so, you know, Andy believes in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Well, that's, you know, somebody might say at some point, well, that's the wrong way to think about this. Let's lock him up and then let's reform him. You know, those kinds of things. So he goes on to talk about that. So it's just a really fascinating essay to talk about with my students. And the idea that retributive justice is actually more humane because it deals with justice, whether something is right or wrong. It has a determined punishment for that right or wrong. You actually, instead of a fault being a disease, you actually are saying to the criminal, no, you are a morally responsible agent. You made a choice that was bad. And that's actually a more dignifying comment than to say that you don't have any control over what you do. It's a disease. So once again, Lewis, writing this a long, long time ago, is giving commentary on 2026. It's just fascinating how prescient he is in a lot of ways.
It reminds me of The Ball and the Cross by G.K. Chesterton, because he was talking about how they would just keep creating diseases. It's like, oh, this guy's got the disease of thinking that somebody stole his boat, you know? And that's just really fascinating. That's really helpful. In fact, I think that almost made me want to read that more than anyway.
What's interesting, so if evolution is true, then we're all meat machines. Like, we're simply machines that operate on input outputs, like environmental causes. And so then if like my iPad's broken, I don't punish it because that's not going to do anything. I reprogram it. And so then you've got like neo-Orthodox theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, or the other Niebuhr brother, who's like saying, if usually men are good, but if we could fix the environment, then the evil would go away and men wouldn't be evil because they're just evil because of their environment. So it you're not seeing it as any justice. You're seeing it as like reprogramming humans. And then same thing today. Why is there all this intersectionality and like all the other stuff? It's because the reason things are bad is our environment's bad, and it sort of shapes us bad. That's very interesting. He is a, in some sense of the term, his writing seems, like you said, prescient or like even prophetic. Like he talks and I'm like, man, this is today. So, okay. So for my books and business, I'll just mention an experience I had that relates to reading. So on Monday, Dr. Kubelia in the systematic theology classes is currently doing his oral exams. So at the end of systematic for the whole year, you're going to have to get up there and it's like a mini ordination. And so you'll pick a doctrine at random and then you have to answer questions about it. And he always asks other faculty to come help him. So there's two people asking questions. And so whoever went had theology proper. And I thought, okay, theology proper. So I pulled up my notes on it that I used to like guide the questions. And as we were working through stuff, labels about God's nature, like aseity and immutability and whatnot. I understood that one, but some other ones that were in the notes I had, which go back to like Dr. Paul, clicked a little more than they normally do. And it was because of the book we're reading by Matthew Barrett in small groups, None Greater, which I would say almost wholesale the first 4 weeks our group struggled. And Barrett sometimes goes to say, this is explain it. Let me explain this. Let me make it easy for you to understand. And then he's like, not making it easy. But I think this is an illustration that when you struggle through, and listener, this is important for you. If you're reading a book that's, you feel like it's over your head, you're not wasting your time. So Doug Wilson says you should read until your brain creaks. We've talked about that before. And it's felt like that in small groups. Sometimes we're reading this book and there's like creaky points where I'm like, does this make sense? But today I think that I saw some of the value, and I would definitely say in the last 4 small group meetings, our discussions have been way better. So there's like a building of knowledge. So listener, if you pick a book to read or someone assigns you a book for in some way in life, and it seems like it's too much for you, keep pushing through, because later you might notice the benefit of it. So I just thought that was kind of I'd share that.
All right. Let's discuss The Weight of Glory. And so this is obviously the essay for which the compilation is named. And in this essay, Lewis is essentially discussing human desire or longing. And we've talked about Lewis a whole bunch on our podcast. One of the ways that we would discuss him and a title given to him would be like a romantic, in a sense. And that would be a very key component of someone who is not in love like with another person, but like romantic as the movement is there's a lot of emphasis on that longing, the desire of what you want. And The Weight of Glory, he's talking a lot about that desire and how it reveals to us that we're made for another world. Like we're made for God and for heaven. And a lot of the early portion of the essay is him interacting with the rightness or the wrongness of human desire and how we, I think to use words that he used, purify or fulfill those desires. So to state it, you know, theologically, are all of man's desires wrong, or does man have good desire that's misplaced in earthly things because he's made for heavenly things? And how it transitions into a discussion of glory is that one of the things Christians are promised is that we will go to heaven and we will be participants in the glory of God in heaven. That not only are we like him, made like him, but we are fully in relationship with God. Like, here's the holy, glorious one, and we're accepted by him. Like, we have a promise of being fully in God. Like, not in the earthly way where we're waiting for it, but we have a promise of that in the future. And so you can see, like, there's a desire, a longing for the person now to have that full glory later. And that's really what this essay is about. The title, Weight of Glory, is actually from the practical section at the very end, where he talks about how we need to view other people and have the weight of glory, like the heaviness of the potential of someone living for eternity. Like, the people we interact with aren't ordinary. They could be in glory someday, so we should feel that weight of glory in how we interact with people now. And so the title of the essay becomes really kind of the practical call that Lewis is going for, is that we should live in light of that glory, especially in how we interact with other people. And so it's a quick summary. How we're going to navigate the discussion is it's open season. So anyone that has a thought, a quote, wants to discuss something, it's kind of just pinball machine here at this point. So, gentlemen.
Well, what if we started off talking about the idea of rewards as consummation? Did you guys have any thoughts on that one? Because I thought his mercenary faith idea was interesting. Then I think also I would say it'd be interesting to ask the question. He brings up the point that if I have a desire, that demonstrates there's like some design behind that. I just thought about it. I don't know if you guys had thoughts on that one. Looks like no thoughts. I'll dive right in. Okay. So at the very beginning, he's talking about, well, there's a famous quote at the beginning I think we should read.
Mud pies?
Yeah, the mud pies. You want to read it?
I don't have it pulled up.
It's classic Lewis. And so he says this. He's talking about our desires, and there are some who would tell us that your desires are a problem. And he refers to Kant, like Immanuel Kant, and then the Stoics. And he said, in a Stoic, if you think about a Stoic, there's someone who tries to make what's internal never upset disordered based on what something is outside of him. So when we talked about contentment like 3 years ago, the word autarkes that Paul uses is a Stoic word. And so no matter what's happening outside of me as a Stoic, I try to internally be the same person. So there's sort of a distinctiveness, like a distinction from me and my feelings. So he says this, he says, I submit that this notion, the idea that our desires are kind of problematic and we shouldn't have any, I submit that this notion has crept in from Kant and the Stoics and has no part in the Christian faith. Indeed, if we consider the unblushing promise of reward, so that God promises to reward us, and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels. So if you look at all the thing God's promising to his people, it's shocking. Like eternal life, the John 10:10 life, life eternally with your maker, like perfect satisfaction, the way you were designed to have it. That is staggering. He says, it would seem then that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he can't imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday or a vacation at the sea. And then he concludes, we are far too easily pleased. And I thought that was that's a really great quote, no matter how you cut it.
Yeah. So when you're specifically getting into the mercenaries, just to connect some dots, it's kind of like, this is my sense of it, is that Lewis is already driving at like 70 mile an hour. And when you read the opening paragraph, you're like trying to jump into a moving car. Like he's already going.
That's
on
a beautiful
something.
Description of so many Lewis things.
Yes. And so, cause the first thing he says is like, what's like the most important virtue? This is me paraphrasing. And a lot of people would say it's unselfishness, but why are we defining something as an un, like a not, you know, why wouldn't we just say love? And so, he's pointing out that we describe virtue as an absence of something, so like unselfish, rather than a positive desire for something, rather than like love. Like love would have an active object. I'm loving another person. Instead of that being the most virtuous thing, it's an unselfish, like I'm restricting myself. And so you like jump into this conversation with Lewis. Why do we describe virtue that way? And then second idea, Christians have this idea that all desire is wrong. But there's actually good desire. Like we are built to desire and love things. And then that is where we transition into that mercenary idea, where like there's a difference between a general who's fighting because the battle is virtuous and we need to win, like good needs to conquer evil, versus a conscription. Like they just paid me money to fight this war. There's a difference between the two. And so like when he says the word mercenary, he's talking about someone who's doing something out of a wrong love versus instead doing it for the right love. And so I don't know.
It had echoes to me of the shepherd who cares about the sheep in the Bible. And then there's like the hired hand who doesn't care. He just wants his paycheck. And so it is like, I desire something, but the reason I desire it's wrong. And then he goes on to say, he gives some examples. So, He says we shouldn't, and notice who he points the blame at. He says we shouldn't be troubled by unbelievers when they say that this promise of reward makes the Christian life a mercenary life. Which if you think of it, if you're outside of Christianity and you hear a Christian say, I'm doing this, I love the Lord, and he's promised me reward, because you are completely in your flesh, you don't have any of the Spirit of God, you can only look at that from the outside and assume you're doing this to get that motivation. You can't have a spiritual assessment of it. And I think there's like a side lesson here is be careful when you're listening to unbelievers. Like they don't have the Spirit of God. They don't have a perspective, not to ever listen to them, but especially when it comes to analyzing motives in life and all that. So then he talks about different kinds of rewards and he brings up money, marriage, the general, like she said, Charlie. And then he even brings up knowledge of Greek, which I thought was, and not just Greek poetry, Charlie.
Yes. Yes, yeah. Gentlemen. And so we're having a literature discussion.
Yes. And so he brings up this point, and I thought this was so good because in my own sanctification, you can see where if you don't have a proper love, then when God says do this because this, that doesn't sound that good. So here he says the proper rewards are not simply tacked on to the activity which they are given, but they are the activity itself in consummation. So he says money is not the natural reward of love. That's why we call a man a mercenary if he marries a woman for the sake of her money. But marriage is the proper reward for a real lover, and he is not a mercenary for desiring it. So I thought that was interesting, is like when you have a proper affection, receiving the reward is a consummation of that really actually good desire, like you're pointing out.
Yeah. Josh, did you have any thoughts on the Greek poetry illustration that he uses with like the schoolboy?
I wasn't going to so much talk about that, but I was going to talk about Wordsworth a little bit,
okay,
which is not Greek poetry, but English poetry. Mm-hmm. So Wordsworth in Lyrical Ballads, which is a collection of poetry that he authors with Samuel Taylor Coleridge, it is kind of the work that literary scholars kind of point to as launching the Romantic movement in poetry. Within an essay, prefatory essay, he uses a description, emotion recollected in tranquility. And that's an important concept for Wordsworth, and that is the idea that you go out and you are within nature and you have this sublime experience, and then to try to revisit that experience, you write a poem about it, and in the tranquility of wherever you are, you can revisit and re-experience the sublimity of being out in the natural world. If you want to see how this works out in poetry, you could read Lime Tree Bower, My Prison by Coleridge, or you could read I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud by Wordsworth. Both of those poems really get at this idea of emotion recollected in tranquility. But what's fascinating, which I should have talked about with my students, is Lewis's point here about what Wordsworth is actually missing in this idea. And he writes, so on page 30 of our text, if Wordsworth had gone back to those moments in the past, he would not have found the thing itself, but only the reminder of it. What he remembered would turn out to be itself a remembering. The books or the music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them. It was not in them, it only came through them, and what came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the thing itself, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers. And so I just thought that was really insightful and something I wish I would have talked about more with my students, about what Wordsworth is leading us to think about, but what he's also missing. And Lewis, in another place, discusses Wordsworth, and he says, Wordsworth is one of these poets that can lead certain people to seek more, to desire something good, true, and beautiful, or he can lead you to become a pantheist. So it's something. And the other thing that I'm reminded of in this passage is my mom talked to me about this, but Shadowlands, and you get a little bit of that in this. We talked a little about it in transposition as well, but just again, kind of the idea of it leaves you longing for the really real. So
the quote you read finishes. He says it'll break the hearts of the worshipers. He says, for they are not the thing itself, only the scent of a flower that we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have not yet visited. And I thought that that description to me fits all experiences of idolatry. So if you've ever pursued something that you're like, this is the thing that's going to satisfy me, one day you get that thing, and if it's not the Lord, it doesn't provide that kind of satisfaction. And so I thought, oh, that is interesting that he's commenting here on these elements, but it really does. I think that fits the biblical record.
Tim, any thoughts on the poetry?
Oh, I loved it. Nope.
Can we go back and mention the Greek thing real quick?
Yeah.
Just real quick. So when he's talking about motivations to do things, and if you're only doing it for the outcome, you're like a mercenary. And he talks about the person who's reading Greek poetry or wants to. And so I'll read sort of a longish quote. He said, an enjoyment of Greek poetry is certainly a proper and not mercenary reward for learning Greek. But only those who have reached the stage of enjoying Greek poetry can tell from their own experience that this is so. The schoolboy beginning Greek grammar cannot look forward to his adult enjoyment of Sophocles as a lover of looks forward to his marriage or a general to his victory. He has to begin by working for marks, or to escape punishment, or to please his parents, or at best in the hope of a future good which he cannot at present imagine or desire. His position therefore bears a certain resemblance to that of a mercenary. The reward he is going to get will in fact be a natural or a proper reward, but he will not know it until he has got it. Now, what I liked about that is that to me sounds like trusting the Lord when I don't understand. So like God tells me this is the best way to live my life. And I look at it and I think that doesn't look very fun. It doesn't look very exciting. I don't think that sounds great. But I have to entrust myself to the one who is omniscient and is all wise. And when I do that, eventually wisdom's fruits are justified. God is exonerated and not mocked. And you actually see that his way of life is living, that living his way of life is actually better. I'm not sure Lewis was making that point, but to me, they were just, that's another parallel where I'm like, hey, that's actually, I think that's right on. And that's maybe a helpful way to think about things early on as you're growing in the Lord.
Yeah. So I think Lewis's point there is really in that next paragraph. So he makes a very simple comparison. The Christian in relation to heaven, or the word we could supply would be glory. The Christian in relation to heaven or glory is in much the same position as this schoolboy. Those who have attained everlasting life in the vision of God doubtless know very well that it is no mere bribe, but the very consummation of their earthly discipleship. But we who have not yet attained it cannot know this in the same way, and cannot even begin to know it at all except by continuing to obey and finding the first reward of our obedience and our increasing power to desire the ultimate reward. So the little boy learning Greek, at first he's doing it because his parents are making him. He has to get good grades. And he, you know, he doesn't yet fully understand, like, no, the real reason for this is so that you can enjoy this poetry later on, and it's going to open up all these things for you. And very similarly, we know heaven is that end for the Christian, but we don't know it that way yet. The way that we are learning it now is through the things that God is taking us through now. I actually highlighted the last sentence of that paragraph. But probably this will not, for most of us, happen in a day. Poetry replaces grammar. Gospel replaces law. Longing transforms obedience as gradually as the tide lifts a grounded ship. Which we would, that is poetry.
Ooh, that was good.
I don't know if it's theology, but if it is theology, that theology is poetry. So I want to talk about the desire. So as a romantic and as a confessional Christian, Lewis is very positive about human longing and human desire. I'll use a word, human passion. The romantic movement would be pro-passion. So how would we read through this? And I do think there's a part of us in our core that really resonates with what Lewis is saying. Like, yes, we long for that thing. How do we balance that out as decently Calvinistic, somewhat fundamental Baptists who believe in the depravity of man? So does that question, can I set the table well for that? Like, can man have a good desire?
So it's interesting. And when he talks about desire, I wonder if like it would be helped to say like there's maybe two kinds of desire. I don't know if this actually works. But you've got like he brings up the point is I have a desire for food, and that's because my body is designed to run on food. So then when I desire food and I consume it, I am healthy. And then he talks about I'm made to desire water, or like because I need to drink water. And so he makes this point that when you have a desire, it often points to design. He doesn't use that word, but that's how I would say it. Like a desire equals a design. So there's like that side of the equation, which there's another element I'd bring up. But then there's the other side. Like, I desire to play video games for 15 hours a day. I don't think I can make the same logical formula. Like, well, God designed me to play video games all day. So that's where I would say, like, there's something here where if we could distinguish between these two, then I think we could reasonably talk about the depravity over here and rightly say what's true over here. But I haven't given it that much thought yet.
I'm kind of thinking about, you know, what you're discussing. So the desire, we're created to desire, to long for relationship with God. We're created to have these, we have desires that are natural, but anything that is a good desire can be perverted into a bad desire. And that's where you're getting like, yeah, it's good to desire to eat food, but you can always take that beyond It's good to, you know, to desire a monogamous relationship that would lead to children with your wife. It's a bad thing to desire that, you know, to not be monogamous, but to, you know, take sex to the extreme, so forth and so on. So it's kind of this idea of the perversion of something that is good, I suppose.
You know, in this whole conversation, I just often think of Ecclesiastes. You know, go eat your bread with joy, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. You know, God has already approved what you do, which is clearly in the context of an individual of faith, of an individual who walks in the fear of God. So the one who's living out the fear of God in their life, then what desires do they have? Okay, they're good desires. They can be anyway. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. By the way, I'm reading Ecclesiastes 9:7-9. Okay, so this would be superfluous stuff. Let your garments be white, your head lack no oil. So clean garments, and then enjoying the things of this world. Finally, in verse 9, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your enigmatic life. You know, and then there's like the twist. The life that you live is enigmatic. It's a puzzle. You can't understand it, which means you have to live by faith. Mm-hmm. And who's the person that can actually take delight and enjoy God's good gifts would be the person who understands that life is enigmatic and has to be lived by faith. So there's, I think I like your idea of like the two different desires. My natural inclination is to say the desires are bad. Okay. And I like to say that the desires are bad because, you know, that's our natural inclination, our fleshly impulses that are just assaulting us all the time. But I wonder if that's too what he's talking about at the very beginning of the book, where he's talking about how our perception of desires are typically bad. Like love, how do we define love? As unselfishness, as a negative. And so I'm wondering if that, my perception is even being tainted a little bit by my struggle with defining love as a positive. The word is so watered down in our human Christian culture, it's become meaningless. So then to actually define it, I define it by its inverse, which is unselfishness, which is problematic. But anyway, what are you guys' thoughts?
Well, I don't know how directly related this is to that specifically, but there's something that you said that reminded me. So in Jane Eyre, when Jane is at Lowood, which is that boarding school that she's first at, and she has this friend, Helen Burns, and Helen Burns is kind of a Christian stoic of sorts. Just, you know, we just have to endure and suffer. And Jane has a very strong sense of justice that's natural within her. And there's this moment where the headmaster, Brocklehurst, comes to visit, and he sees this girl with red hair that's curly, and he tells the ladies that are watching the girls to cut the girl's hair because we are not supposed to, you know, follow our natural inclinations. We're to repress our natural desires. And so what's happening there, of course, it's an absurd example. And Charlotte Bronte is saying Brocklehurst clearly doesn't understand the difference between kind of dispositions that are natural and then those that are fleshly and sinful. And so her hair is naturally that way. There are certain things about us that are natural, right, and desirable and good and should be fostered and enjoyed as a gift. And then there's our flesh that we have to fight against, and we do try to restrain and those kinds of things. So I don't know how directly it relates. I just was thinking about that as a literary example.
So I don't know when the time to interject this is, but as an apologetics teacher, I just want to, on this point, say I had heard him, and maybe the quote is coming up and I've missed it. He says, if I find a desire in myself that nothing in this world can satisfy, it seems to indicate I must have been made for another world. And I'd always heard that and thought, that's kind of capricious. You're kind of just saying what you want to say. Here, though, the argument lays it out. If I have hunger, it appears to me then that I am designed to need food. And he says, a man's physical hunger doesn't prove he will get food or bread. He may die of starvation on a raft in the Atlantic, but surely a man's hunger does prove that he comes from a race which repairs its body by eating, and the inhabitants of a world where eatable substances exist. And I thought that was fascinating when he took that and then said, he even talked about a man may love a woman and may not win her, but it would be very odd phenomenon if the phenomenon of called falling in love occurred in a world like a sexless world. And I'm like, well, that's interesting to like play that out. So then if all humans suffer from a desire for this kind of a satisfaction that nothing on this earth in its sinful brokenness or in my sinful condition can actually experience, if you're an evolutionist, well, that could be an accidental desire your body has. But if you're a creationist and we are the way we're designed, that appears to show that there is possibly something else coming where that design could have been met out. I don't know what to do with that other than that is an way more intriguing hearing it here than just that one quote out of context.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that a little bit more. And so if we're just material, what do we do with these desires? So that, in essence, what you're asking.
Yeah.
And so it's survival instinct, you know, to have these things. At some point, your romantic, spiritual longings are just you trying to survive. Like you have to explain it away somehow.
Yep. Some sort of historical advantage.
So
yeah.
On this idea, the quote from Abolition of Man comes to mind. So my question with these desires, like theologically, are we okay with mankind unredeemed having good desire? And so, but here's the quote from Abolition. We make men without chests and expect from them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. So like, is there some way that a non-Christian human made in the image of God desires something that's right for them to desire, even if it's in like some shadow form? That's me punting that to the table.
So I think there's the possibility that those exist for at least one reason and possibly two. I do think because of sin, all of those have a level of taint. So total depravity means yep. I'm not as wicked as I could be, but everything I do is tainted by sin. But then secondly, oh, did it fly out of my head? Your question. It may come back to me. There was another one that was even more. It'll come back in a minute. But just so when we were created, and then especially when Adam and Eve sinned, we have moral knowledge built into us.
Yeah.
And we don't always get every moral decision we make wrong. That's the point of the Tao in Abolition.
Correct. Yeah.
So if we have some moral knowledge and we have some moral idea of what's right, there has to be at times where there's some virtue, I would think, that's possible. But I'm with you. I don't think it'd be totally virtuous. Unredeemed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it could be totally
virtuous. Well, I think that's where the illustration of like Greek poetry is where he goes, where they have some conception of glory and honor, but for them it's the gods. It's not Jesus. And so like they've got some shadowy idea of it, but it's still tainted because they don't actually know him. Like that's kind of what I feel like he's doing.
And I think that's fair. And I would also say, I think there's a break at the like scientific revolution enlightenment era. I think on the backside of that, I think the way people are thinking about humans and anthropology is like super broken.
Yeah.
Even when it gets like one thing right, it's like the Karl Barth stop clock is right twice a day situation. So I think post enlightenment is way less likely to get something right.
Yeah. All right. So you guys don't have any other new topic, any other new quotes? So I will say, we've read multiple phrases and portions of this really large block. So in speaking of this desire for our own far off country, it's the same paragraph that Josh was reading from about Wordsworth. You know, if Wordsworth had gone back to these moments in the past, he would not have found the thing itself. That whole chunk there, I just wrote one little note there and I put leisure. Like, okay, we're going to go out and we're in nature and we're contemplating, but the thing we're contemplating isn't like, man, I like trees. It's not about the tree. It's the thing behind the tree and above the tree. And there's that mystery of the spiritualness of life And that's where, like, if Wordsworth is just trying to capture in a poem that feeling, he's going to be, he's making idols. But the moment that a man can go to that and realize the true thing behind it and the true thing in front of it, like forward, heaven, that's the heart of leisure. And so that whole chunk there, that paragraph that starts with, in speaking of this desire for our own far off country, if you're reading through Josef Pieper and you're like, what is leisure? That paragraph is leisure. That helps you get closer to it. Maybe it's not exactly the thing, but what else do you guys have? Any other quotes?
I think the next major portion of this essay is all about glory.
Yes.
And so we don't have to talk about all that right now, but I think I'd bring up that I liked his definition. I'd never thought of glory this way. Whether it's biblically accurate, I have not yet tested, but I to me, I'm like, there's a ring of truth in this. And then he says something else that I want to clarify. And I thought, wow, that is cool. So we're probably, my Kindle edition says we're on page 40, but he has a final sentence in a paragraph. He's been talking about glory for quite a while now. There are two kinds in his mind. There's like the fame kind and the luminosity kind, but then he introduces a third kind, which he says is like a good report or appreciation by someone else. At the end of this section, he quotes, the quote I have is this. He says, "For glory means a good report with God, acceptance by God, response, acknowledgement, and welcome into the heart of things. The doors on which we have been knocking all our lives will open at last." And I thought, there is something there about glory that resonates. I mean, is it? And so then he goes on to say, he says, "Perhaps it seems rather crude to describe glory as the fact of being noticed by God, but this is almost the language of the New Testament. St. Paul promises to those who love God, not as we would expect, that he will know them, that they will know him, but that they will be known by him, 1 Corinthians 8:3. A strange promise. Does not God know all things at all times? But it is dreadfully re-echoed in another passage in the New Testament. There we are warned what may happen to any one of us who appear at last before the face of God and hear only the appalling words, 'I never knew you. Depart from me.'" And then I have this next line highlighted. "In some sense, as dark to the intellect as it is unendurable to the feelings, we can both be banished from the presence of him who is present everywhere and erased from the knowledge of him who knows all. We can be utterly and absolutely left outside, repelled, exiled, estranged, and finally and unspeakably ignored." I thought there was something to that that I had never considered about my desire to know the Lord. In fact, the times in my life, I think, where I've considered what it will be like to actually meet the Lord, and I've been like moved to tears, which has not been a ton, but I wonder if that's part of like, I'm made to know my Maker, and here it's, and I also don't want my Maker mad at me. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I think he was onto something there. I thought that was very perceptive, but I have not biblically checked it out.
Yeah. So that whole section there, like the knocking of the door illustration, I think is really interesting. And I'll just call to mind the further up, further in Narnia, where he, I think, starts to adopt that language just a few pages over. So I'm actually going to go earlier. It's the end of the paragraph right before where you started. And I would put that like acceptance idea of the glory underneath of his like fame. Like, we're not famous, but there's like accolade, like there's like you've won like a victory kind of thing to it. And that's because God has paid for our sin and we're accepted in Christ. That's kind of the backdrop I have here. But that end of the paragraph previous, to please God, to be a real ingredient in the divine happiness, to be loved by God, not merely pitied, but delighted in, as an artist delights in his work or a son, it seems impossible. A weight or burden of glory, there's your title, which our thoughts can hardly sustain. Like, that can't be, that God would actually delight in me. but so it is. That is such a good paragraph.
That's
now,
glorious.
Now jump a couple paragraphs to the right, and he says this. He's talking about that same idea, like we're on the wrong side of the door.
What page?
I don't know. Well,
I'll find it. Go ahead.
So it's so there's the paragraph that Andy read the end of it, and it's two paragraphs after that. So it starts with, and this brings me to the other sense of glory. Glory is brightness, splendor, luminosity. As he's talking there, he gets into this idea like, we don't just want to look at that light. We want to, he literally says, we want to bathe in the beauty of that light. And you, there's a place where he starts talking about the in and the out again. For if we take the imagery of Scripture seriously, if we believe that God will one day give us the morning star and cause us to put on the splendor of the sun, then we may surmise that both the ancient myths and the modern poetry, so false as history, may be very near the truth as prophecy. At present, we are on the outside of the world, the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and purity of morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. We cannot mingle with the splendors that we see. But all the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. Someday, God willing, we will get in. That is poetry. All the leaves of the New Testament, that is such a good line. But the idea of this glory is that we're actually going to be full participants in the unbridled glory, luminosity of God when we get there. And there's like this built-in desire for that in every human. I don't know exactly where we were going with those statements, but really beautiful. I said, even just to read it, it stirs it in you, right?
And then, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I'm going to anyway. But it's that beauty of those lines and the truth that he's revealing there that then compels us to go out and look at our neighbors and to see them not as just, as you said, meat machines, but as people who might also share in this glory. And so I just, yeah, the ending, that famous passage, is just, in light of what you just read, Charlie, is sticking out to me afresh.
Yeah. Any last thoughts? I have a way that I'd like to cap it.
So just coming back to like what Andy was talking about, his definition of glory is kind of new to me. The whole title of the article, The Weight of Glory, builds off of the at least Hebrew idea of the definition of glory. So the Hebrew root, kavad, means to be heavy. And the heavy individual was glorious in that you couldn't move them because they're big and they're heavy. And so there's a correlation between those two words. It's the same Hebrew word. To say that somebody's heavy is to say somebody is has glory, because you can't move them. And so I thought he was going to build off of that kind of idea or definition, but he really kind of didn't. Instead, he kind of went down this road of like knowing God, which was what Andy was hitting on. That was page 41. Perhaps it seems rather crude to describe glory as the fact of being noticed by God. And I'm just going to say that I haven't thought through the idea of glory from that perspective. The Bible talks a lot about us knowing God and our attempts to do so. In fact, it's something that I was even studying this week. It's something I started studying last fall because of my paper on God in the Song of Songs. Because it states in Hosea chapter 2 that they will know the Lord. Yeah, in chapter 2, verse 20, I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you will know the Lord. And then throughout Hosea, it's talking about the children of Israel. They don't know the Lord, and they need to know the Lord and the knowledge of God. And it's a massive theme And I haven't ever worked through that too significantly. So when we were working through this, it just recalled for me this idea of knowing God. But what I've never done is combined those two ideas, glory and knowledge. So I'm going to punt as well and just say, I'm not sure. I haven't really wrestled with the correlation of those two ideas. Weight and glory, yes. Knowledge and glory, no. And the concept that is a little bit foreign is the knowing that God knows, because throughout the Bible that I can recall just on a whim right here, and it's in Hosea, is that God does know, and he knows us. And so this aspect, you're being ignored by God because of your rebellion. Okay, that's an interesting concept I want to think through some more.
All right. Oh, more or not more?
No. Well, if there is, I'll interrupt you, but I don't think so.
Okay. So the last paragraph of this essay is just so beautiful. I want to read the whole thing. And so if you just want to skip ahead like a minute and a half to the final meditation, you can do that. But we're going to read the statement or the paragraph that starts with, meanwhile, the cross. So it's the last paragraph. And if I mispronounce the Latin that he gets to, I never studied Latin. All right. Meanwhile, the cross comes before the crown, and tomorrow is a Monday morning. A cleft has opened in the pitiless walls of the world, and we are invited to follow our great captain inside. The following him is, of course, the essential point. That being so, it may be asked what practical use there is in the speculations which I have been indulging. I can think of at least one such use. It may be possible for each to think too much of his own potential glory hereafter. It is hardly possible for him to think too often or too deeply about that of his neighbor. The load or weight or burden of my neighbor's glory should be laid on my back. A load so heavy that only humility can carry it, and the backs of the proud will be broken. It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you can talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship it, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all only in a nightmare. All day long, we are, in some degree, helping each other to one or other of these destinations. It is in the light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is with the awe and the circumspection proper to them, that we should conduct all our dealings with one another, all friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. This does not mean that we are to be perpetually solemn. We must play. But our merriment must be of that kind, and it is, in fact, the merriest kind, which exists between people who have, from the outset, taken each other seriously. No flippancy, no superiority, no presumption. And our charity must be a real and costly love with a deep feeling for the sins in spite of which we love the sinner. No mere tolerance or indulgence which parodies love as flippancy parodies merriment. Next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, your neighbor is the holiest object presented to your senses. If he is your Christian neighbor, he is holy in almost the same way, for in him also Christ veri latitat is truly hidden. The glorifier and the glorified, glory himself, is truly hidden. All right, so right on the heels of that, let's have a final meditation in 1 Peter 1. So we're talking about participating in the glory of heaven, and a lot of discussion about that. I think, and this is where my mind went, 1 Peter 1, as obedient children, do not be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, since it is written, you shall be holy for I am holy. So we are children of God. I definitely think that term here means we're in the realm of believers. And what is a believer supposed to do here? What does Peter want them to do? You should not be conformed on the desires of your ignorance. So even maybe a good desire that's tainted by your sinfulness, that should not be what forms you. You should not be crammed into a mold of ignorant passion. But the opposite of that, you should be holy. I'm going to supply another word. You should be glorious. You should match your character to the God who made you, the one that you will eventually, in full consummation, be like and in and with for eternity. You should be holy. Why? Because he who called you is holy. The one who made you is holy. By the way, what does the Bible say? It's written, you should be holy, for I am holy. That's what God says in Leviticus. So don't be conformed to passions in an irreverent, unholy way. But recognizing the beauty and the goodness of God, you should strive to be holy, to be glorious. And just as Lewis said there at the end of his essay, this should, that weight of that glory should impact everything you do. That's exactly what Peter says. Holiness isn't just a part of my life. It's the whole life. He says it there, don't be conformed, but be holy in all your conduct. So in everything I do, reflecting the consummation that I will have with my Heavenly Father, like the weight of that day when I am in full splendor before Him, accepted in the blood of Christ, partying with Him for eternity. That should sprinkle in and cover and completely immerse everything I do right now. So every action I take should be done in the goal to live in that glory now. And that's what Peter is commanding to early Christians encountering persecution, and that is still really relevant to us today, to live in light of that future glory. So hopefully you've enjoyed reading through The Weight of Glory with us and the discussion today, and we'll see you on another episode next week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.